we are starting a new series, as Vince mentioned. It's a series that we're titling When the Bible Came Alive to Me. So we have a lot of people coming from different backgrounds in this church, is something that we talk a lot about. And so people have very varied experiences with the Bible. Some people have lots of experiences. Some people have not so much experience. Some of them are mostly positive, and some of them might be filled with some negative experiences. For me personally, as somebody who grew up going to church, and more than that, having my parents be pastors, I grew up with a very involved relationship with the Bible. It was something I can't even remember a time it wasn't present in my life. You know, and it was always presented as a super important thing, something to be treated with respect and reverence, and it found its way into life all the time. So, like, when I would ask why questions growing up, why does it have to be this way? Why does the world work? Why do I have to go to school? All of those types of questions. Almost all of those, whether it was at church or at home, would find some kind of Bible quote or reference into the answer, kind of masterfully woven in. Like, I would ask the question, why do I have to go to school today? I don't want to go to school. And they would say things to me, my family would say, well, you have to go to school because you need to learn things to become smarter and open yourself up to opportunities and options for life because, like Jesus said in Luke 12, to those who much has been given, much is expected. And Kyle, you have been given much with your access to education, and so it's important that you make the most out of it. This was like a common experience for me. It wasn't just the advice from my parents. The Bible found its way into that. And so as I got older, there were some clear expectations put around me in the kind of cultural bubble that I was in, being in a very secular area and city in Evanston, but going to church and having that be a thing that was informing my life a lot. And in that church setting, it was pretty clear that as I got older, I should be getting more and more familiar with the Bible for myself. You know, and this was wrapped up, actually, this was like a message that really first gained a lot of prominence in the Reformation, but really got its life in the last 50 to 100 years with the rise of evangelicalism. You know, there's a message that I think I summarize in my youth and my childhood of growing up of something along the lines of, like, more Bible, more better. Worse grammar, though. But essentially, it could be summarized as any exposure to the Bible is good exposure to the Bible. Just the more you have Bible in your life, the better. And I remember this was really deeply embedded into my thinking. It was deeply embedded into my psyche. And so when I was 18 years old and I graduated from high school and I moved to Australia for a year to work with a church, something kind of startling happened to me. And it was this time I'm meeting these people in this other church, and these other Christians start to talk about how they read the Bible, and they're interpreting things different from how I had interpreted them, or the ways that my family or my church had talked about the meaning. And it really blew my mind. It was kind of like, because I grew up in a place that was predominantly not church-going, my only real exposure of churches was my church. And so the idea that there's these other people that are faithfully going to church, but seeing different interpretations than what I had understood, was super challenging to me. And so I remember thinking, quite heroically, I wonder how I can help them see where they're wrong. God must have sent me to this church to correct the error of their ways. But the reality was, is there's a lot of adults and people here who had read and was more familiar with the Bible than I was. And like, I had a lot of little teachings that I knew, but the reality was they had actually spent more time reading it. And so I decided while I was in Australia, I'm away, I don't have a real job, I'm going to read through the entire Bible. I'm going to read it in entirety, which I had never done or really attempted to do, which is not unusual. It's a recent poll from Lifeway that found out of churchgoers, only 11% even claim to have read the entire Bible, which means you take like 2% that are probably lying, and so you're like 9% of people who go to church read the entire Bible. So it's not like I'm doing something out of the normal. It's just the Bible is really big, and it's a lot, and I was 18, and I can barely finish novels. So I hadn't, but at this point, you know, I have a year away, I'm doing this thing, and I'm going to read the whole Bible. And in my mind, I'm going to read the whole Bible because then I will understand what it's saying and how to correct this church. because of course what I had thought going in would be just validated by what I read. The problem was, it's not exactly what happened. As I began to read the entire Bible, I began finding myself deeply confused. And it became kind of clear that like 90% of the teachings that I had heard in church were on like 5% of the Bible. And when I got through the whole thing, I did. I spent that year, it took me about 6 months of just sitting down and reading and reading and reading. And a lot of those kind of like, I've read this paragraph 4 times. I still don't know what it says, but I have to move on. And what happened was, is my head just kind of was spinning. I found myself drawn to things that were deeply conflicting internally, and things that I saw that seemed to be conflicting even within the text. Like, I remember looking at where, you know, one area it says Paul is telling the church in Rome that you need to respect your rulers and leaders because God put them in place, and so you must respect them. But then earlier, I just had read where Isaiah was saying that these rulers are evil, and God is against them, and God is going to rise up and crush them. And I was like, I'm very confused on how that fits together. Or I find myself going over passages that describe violence or like genocide or things that were happening at the hands of God's chosen people. And then reading Jesus' words of like, love your enemy, turn your other cheek, deeply confused. And it got me into a place of crisis. It got me into a place where the more I was reading the Bible, the more I was questioning things. And it got me to a place where I even wondered, maybe it's more Bible, more problems. Vince and I had entirely too much fun with this as we were talking about this week. But the truth is, because my experience was more Bible without context, without background, without other wise people to talk to, without a healthy sense of humility, without these things, I would argue history would show us that the more Bible has not always been more better. But in the years since then, I've actually come to find that I think that there's a bit of a middle ground. Between more Bible, more better, and more Bible, more problems, a middle ground of thoughtful, informed engagement of the Bible, shot through with humility, that I think allows the Bible to come alive. And that's been my experience. And that's what we want to spend our time on this summer in this series of talks. Vince and I want to share some stories. We want to share some concepts, some ideas. We want to share some particular moments where all of a sudden the Bible came alive to us, where it became the wonderful tool it is to us today. A tool that has helped us better connect with God, a tool that has helped us better connect with community, that has helped us grow and be challenged, and really powerfully widened our worldview, widened our picture of what's happening, big picture. And so today, I'm going to be kicking this off, and over this series, we're going to be looking at this. Sometimes it's going to be, this was one point, like one point I'll talk about another time when I was in Australia, that I read Psalm 86, and it blew up in meaning to me. And then sometimes we're going to talk about things like I'm talking about today, which is something that is kind of a concept, something about an idea that helped us approach the Bible in a helpful way. And so today I want to look at something that is actually was a large focus of my own studies in undergrad and grad school, and it's the role of culture and theology. And so to help us do that, I want to look at a few cultural paradigms. I think they can also be seen as like on a spectrum, and I want to draw special attention to something. And the special attention I want to draw is that across any of the paradigms of culture that we understand, our modern American culture is on the polar opposite in almost every single category as the ancient Near Eastern cultures the biblical writers lived in. And I think that that has a lot of profound implications for the ways that we approach the Bible and then sometimes the way that we can misunderstand the Bible. So the first of these spectrums that I want to point to is power distance. So on one side you see here we have low power distance, or egalitarian, which I have written down. This is what American culture is. This is us here today. It's more of a democratic style. Power is shared between people. The expectation is in general you can move up and down power structure. You're not like stuck in what you are for life. Subordinates are encouraged to take initiative, to think freely. They're not really expected to be overly deferential to their managers. And it's totally acceptable to disagree or question somebody that might be a superior. You know, it tends to be a fairly informal setting. That's what we are here in America. On the other end, you have what the ancient Near Eastern culture of the Bible was. It tends to be more hierarchical, authoritarian. Power is held in one group and one person. And they have the power, which means they have the power, and we don't question why they have the power. You just defer to it. And it tends to be very formalized in how these things work, and there's not a lot of expectation that you would or should be moving up and down in these structures. You know, I think about one example that's always helped me think about this in terms of power structure is after college, I spent a year teaching English in Korea. And what happens in any academic setting is a student will get in trouble. And what also happens in any academic setting is the teacher and the student will have slightly different versions of the same event, usually pointing at the other as the one at fault. And working in elementary schools today, what I often see is parents will often take their child's side. They'll hear their child's story and they'll back them up, or I would say at least consider the child's in hand with the teacher's story of what happened. Well, when I was teaching English in Korea, this was certainly not the case. The teacher is the authority. The student is the subordinate. And so if a student got in trouble, a parent did not care what the student said. That was not considered. It was what the teacher said. The teacher said this. They're in charge. That's all that matters. They wouldn't even want to really hear out the students and what was happening. It was a different power structure, where the authority lives. Where I think about a week ago, I was with a teenager who has no real church experience, no experience with the Bible, or has never really lived in the kind of the Christian subculture of America. It's always really fascinating chatting with her because it's like this total outside view of things that I grew up in. And we were talking about culture at large, like American culture, and particularly how women are treated as she's a teenage girl and understanding these things in a different way. And we were talking particularly in light of the changes that have happened over the last year. And she knows I'm a pastor, and so she asks me about something that a religious person had said to her. And essentially, this religious person had said to her something that she interpreted as saying that women were just fundamentally inferior to men. And that this friend had actually quoted this guy, Paul, from the Bible to validate what they were saying. And so my response to her was that I actually thought reading Paul in context, in his culture, a hierarchical, high power distant culture, that Paul's words would have actually been seen as pretty feminist. That the fact that Paul told men to honor and respect their wives, and then in turn addressed women just as he addressed men in the same breath, that in that culture, in that context, that would have been seen as a feminist statement. And I just didn't say anything after that. I hadn't even finished my thought. And she interrupts me and she goes, well, then at the very least in our culture, women should be treated as equals. And it was like to her, that was a logical leap. If you're moving from a high power distance culture to a low power distance culture, if you're challenging power and a high power distance culture, should we not at least challenge it the same in a low power distance culture? It was just interesting to think about. Or think about the next paradigm I want to suggest that we look at, which is locus of control. So you have an internal locus of control, and you have an external locus of control. Internal is what we are in America. I control my fate. There are a few things in life that I can't change. Where there's a will, there's a way. I pull myself up by my bootstraps. The power in the world, the control in the world is held with me. Life is what you make of it. You are happy by seizing your happiness. This is opposed to the external locus of control culture, which is what the ancient Near Eastern culture of the Bible was, where we have little control over what happens to us. You know, I can't do much to change my lot in life. My success or lack thereof is due to good or bad fortune. It's out of my hands. It's an external control. And so I find happiness in life by coming to terms with my circumstances. You know, one thing I think is interesting to note about culture, and I think Locus of Control particularly highlights it, is culture is not created in a vacuum. It evolves in context. And I think it's interesting that the majority of the cultures in our world that are internal locus of control come from places that have historically experienced prosperity. Places that have taught, yes, you can make things happen in your life. Whereas the majority of places that have a deeply external locus of control are places that have historically been marked with suffering and challenge. That history informs the cultures we have. It's hard to feel a deep internal locus of control if you don't have stories of people that are making the changes happen in life. You know, there's a study that happened a little while back, and when I came across this, it kind of blew my mind. So they took a whole bunch of American students, and they took a whole bunch of Russian students, and they had them both read the parable of the prodigal son. If you're not familiar with this story, it goes like this. So essentially, there is a son who asks for his inheritance early from his father. I want you to give me all of your money now before you die. And then he gives it to him. And then quoting from Luke 15, it says, "Not long after that, the younger son got all he had, set off for a distant country, and there squandered his wealth in wild living. After he had spent everything, there was a severe famine in that whole country, and he began to be in need." And essentially, this turns into him returning home in need, afraid of what that will mean. But surprisingly, the father welcomes him back lovingly, caringly, and kind of brings him back into the household, much to his brother's unhappiness. So they ask these students, tell us, what do you guys take out of this story? What does it mean? Like, repeat it back to us. Tell us what you think. And they saw one really distinct difference between the American students and the Russian students. Only 6% of the American students mentioned the fact that there was a famine at all. Whereas 84% of the Russian students mentioned the famine as the primary reason that the prodigal son was forced to return home. See, the internal locus of control Americans see this parable as a critique of the son's wild living. It is his personal moral failings, and he is now suffering because of his own personal failings. But thankfully, as God welcomes us with grace, he was welcomed back with forgiveness from his father. The external locus of control Russians, whose own history was marked by one of the world's largest famines of a century ago, they saw this and they point out the fact that actually, even though the son squandered his wealth, he would have been fine had there not also been a famine. That there were structures in place in this society to take care of somebody that didn't have money. But those structures fell apart because of the famine. Oh, 94% of the Americans didn't even see famine in the text. 84% of the Russians saw this as the primary reason. And so it changes what this parable is saying. It's not saying that, you know, the wild living and the personal moral failings don't matter, but rather it's saying the Russians read this as saying it isn't exclusively about personal morality and the grace of God. It's pointing to the protection and safety, the care that God offers us, whether it is our own errors or external forces that put us into need. I just think it's really meaningful, the shift that we see based off of our culture. The next paradigm I want to look at here is the concept of self. On one end, you have individualist, which I've also put as guilt-innocence because they are intrinsically linked. And the other one is collectivist, which I've also put honor-shame. And America is deeply individualist, perhaps the most individualist society that has ever been created. The self is of the utmost importance. Children are taught that their value, what your task as a parent is to teach your children independence, to take care of themselves. What matters is your own personal standing in whatever world you're in. Freedom is the highest value. And this is opposed to a collectivist culture, which is what the ancient Near Eastern world was. You're only as good as the group you're a part of. group harmony is the highest value. That is, to me, I remember the first time I read this, and like my mind didn't understand what that meant. That more important than personal justification, more important than moral upstandingness, is group harmony. I'm such an individualist that it still doesn't totally make sense to me. Children are taught not to be independent. That's ridiculous. You are taught to learn how to depend on others and make sure others can depend on you. And the group recognition is way more important than your personal. You know, the thing about this that I spent the most time thinking about is the concept of sin or wrongdoing. In an individualist culture, the emphasis is always on personal morality. Are you guilty or are you innocent? In a collectivist culture, where there's a focus on group harmony, it isn't necessarily about guilty or not. Like, certainly personal morality matters, but it matters because of the effect it has on the group. It is not in a vacuum. Your wrongdoing is bad, not just because it's objectively bad, but because of the effect it has on the whole. You know, the biggest thing this helped me with is, you might be familiar that much of the Old Testament is talking about these purity or cleanliness laws. On guilt-innocence terms, which is how I grew up, they made literally no sense to me at all. Like, I could not understand why God cared so much about how clean people were. But you see these on a collectivist term. A wandering, nomadic people that don't have a government structure around them, they don't have plumbing, they don't have any of those things in place. And you think about how these purity or cleanliness laws would matter on a collectivist honor-shame society, and it makes so much more sense why these things matter. The last thing I want to touch on here, the last paradigm, and there is way more paradigms than this, but these are just the four that I had time on. I actually note, I had to cut 2,000 words from this sermon to make it short, and I still hadn't finished my thoughts yet. And so if you want to talk more about this, I will. This is like my favorite subject in the world, so let's grab coffee. But the last one I want to talk about here is value orientation. On one side, you have universalists. This is what America is. And again, America might be the most universalist country that the world has ever seen. What is right is always right, objectively right, and it applies to everybody all the time, no matter what. Fair means treating everybody the same and holding everybody to the same standards. On the other side, you have particularists. This is what the ancient Near Eastern culture was of the Bible. What is right is based on circumstance and situation. What is right at one point or context may not be right at another. Fair means treating everybody uniquely based on relationship and context. You know, my favorite example of this is something where it talks, let's imagine you own a small business. You have one opening, you need to hire somebody. You get two applicants. The first applicant, super qualified, tons of experience. It is obvious they would be excellent for the job. The second person's your cousin. He is terrible at every job he does. He is not qualified for this and has no experience whatsoever. A universalist would say this is an obvious choice. It is obviously the qualified person. They meet the requirements. They're a better candidate. It's the right decision. To do otherwise would be nepotism. Woo! You know, nepotism, that is such a terrible thing. It degrades our society when that's what happens. You ask a particularist, they'd say, you hire your cousin. There's no question about this. Who cares if that other person's more qualified? Who is that other person to you? Nobody. In context, to not hire your cousin would be considered a moral wrong. You know, when it comes to experiencing the Bible as helpful, I think Americans run into especially hard problems when it comes to this. You know, we ask, and I've asked this, lots of people I know ask this, if the Bible is meant to be the ultimate authority, if it's meant to be the everlasting tool for which we pursue Jesus, why isn't it more obvious and clear? Why couldn't it be written in a way that is everybody gets, everybody understands, and we're all on the same page with? It just seems like, why didn't God do that? First off, only a universalist would ask that question. Like we need it to be right and right and right for all times, clearly for right. But I actually think even universalists are slowly realizing that there's something missed here. Because the truth is, particularists don't ever have this problem with the Bible. The Bible is helpful and clear and timeless because it's not possible for anything to be communicated without context. It's not possible for anything to matter without context. So of course the Bible would be that case. And of course the writers and the original audience to as particularists would see this. You know, and I think about how hard and impossible a universalist writing would even be. Like, so have you ever watched a 90s sitcom? Like, go back and watch, like, a Home Improvement I watched recently. You know what my takeaway is every time I watch a 90s sitcom? It's like, that is super racist and sexist. I cannot believe that was on TV. You think about that, it's like 15, 20 years later, and we are already aware of how much culture has changed, let alone trying to communicate something over thousands of years. So to me, the only way to decipher a timeless truth with any level of depth and meaning is to say, what did it mean to them? And what would be the closest equivalent to us today? You know, and I think I've highlighted, and so you've probably noticed, that on every single one of these spectrums, you could not be further apart in American Western culture than the ancient Near Eastern culture of the Bible. I think this is incredibly important, because by not considering culture, my experience personally has been that religious people can tend to totally misunderstand things from the Bible and then defend those misunderstandings with reasons like, God makes the rules, not me. Or, also has been my experience, those that are not religious can tend to dismiss the Bible as antiquated or worthless. Why are we giving an ancient text any authority over us today? I have felt both of those before. But I don't think either one is actually the helpful place to live. I actually think that there's a reasonable place in the middle ground where we neither throw the Bible out nor we read it without critically thinking about culture, critically thinking about context and history. And that is what we are about at BLV. That is our commitment here, is that the Bible is incredibly, immensely, unexchangeably helpful to us. But we must approach it responsibly. And that's what we're hoping to do over this summer. We're hoping to do a series of talks about when the Bible has come alive to us. Because the Bible coming alive to us has been a gift. And we think it will be a gift to you too. It's a gift that pulls us out of our very narrow 21st century American perspective. It's a gift in the way that it places each of our individual pursuits of life in God in a context so much larger than us. It's a gift in the way it leads us to actual interaction with God. If we read the Bible and feel like we understand it clearly and it is so obvious to us and it is just an information grab, we can go through our life feeling like that's the purpose of the Bible and never actually turn to the God it's written for. Because I think the Bible, above all else, is this incredible tool to lead us into interaction and relationship with the loving God that Jesus showed humanity. And so today, what I would love to actually encourage us all to do is, if you're game, if you're interested, that you would pray that God would help you discover the Bible in a new way. That if your background has taught you to lean towards, well, God makes the rules, not me. Yes, that feels like a massive red flag. Yes, that feels really concerning. Yes, that seems incompatible with understanding God is good. But I don't make the rules, God does. So just pay attention to that red flag in yourself and not explain it away. And rather, ask that God would embolden you to humbly ask critical questions of the Bible. Or alternatively, if you find yourself leaning towards a dismissal, like the Bible's just, it's just not helpful, that God would help your heart find a place that finds the humility or the space to ask, I wonder if I'm missing something here. And that's our goal throughout this series, is try to think through, encourage, grab a hold of a middle ground. a place where the Bible comes alive in meaning and value, where we don't have to hand wave parts of it. We don't have to pretend that everything is obvious, but at the same time, we don't dismiss it as something not helpful to us. And so I'm really excited that this summer we're going to be able to dive into that together. And my hope and my prayer is that you will find the Bible to be helpful in a way that maybe it always has been to you, and this is just like a happy to jump on this train, or maybe in a new way that feels like something that is kind of abstract or something that feels distant can actually feel helpful, closer, accessible. And so what I'd love to do is I'd actually love to invite everybody to stand with me. And I'm going to pray. Jesus, I first ask for help in seeing the water that I swim in, my own culture. The things that I bring to the table, the lenses I have. So helpful to be aware of those, not even in just engaging the Bible, but engaging life and other humans. And so, Jesus, I just ask for help right now, almost like we would, oh, I'm wearing glasses. I didn't even know where those were. That you would help us begin to see and discover our own culture. And then, Jesus, I ask for help in engaging with the Bible for those that are interested or want that. And that we would find some freedom internally, not to like dismiss and hand wave the things that feel like red flags to us, but also not dismiss something as unhelpful. And I just ask for help, even as we do with our kids' ministry. I just am so excited every time I have watched one of the things they do in there, because the goal here is not this is the life lesson you need to take away. The goal is, why don't you wonder at what this means? Interact with Jesus, the living God. Interact with him and wonder at this. And Jesus, I ask for help to do that. That I'm so thankful for the ways that you have used the Bible as a tool to pull me out of myself, to challenge me in ways that I need to be challenged, to encourage me in ways that I need to be encouraged. But I'm also not going to lie and pretend like every single part of the Bible just glows with wonderful feelings for me. And I'm thankful for the relationship and connection that I have found in asking you, Jesus. I wonder if I'm missing something. I wonder if my perspective's too narrow. Jesus, I just pray that this community would feel like a safe place to process those things, that we wouldn't feel like we have to report back things that aren't true to us, that we could process the challenges we have, process the helpfulness that we find in our pursuit of faith. And as we transition now into a time of singing and prayer, we just invite everyone here to engage in whatever way feels best. Stand up, sit down, receive it, dance, rejoice. And while that's happening, we'll also have a team of people available to pray in that middle section, to pray with you about any needs you may have coming in today, circumstantial, physical. But I would also encourage, if you feel a complicated relationship with the Bible or a complicated history of how it's been applied to you, I encourage you to consider having somebody pray with you over that. We find that God seems to show up in pretty cool and surprising ways when we have somebody else come alongside us in that practice. And they're not weird people. They're very normal human beings who are just going to be human with you. They're not going to give you unasked for advice or say things that don't make any sense to you. And it's just going to be a safe place to do this with somebody else. And as that's happening, these folks are going to lead us in song.